Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, continuing our conversations about the cultures of consciousness. I think we can all agree that we've reached a place of rapidly declining trust in many of the authorities and features of society that claim to know what's going on multiple dimensions. It's a rather giddy and somewhat terrifying ride. And I would say that one of those features is the fact that after centuries of science, medicine, psychiatry, psychology, that we still really have no idea what it means to be mentally disturbed, to be crazy, to be mad. And yet, anybody who encounters with people on the far end of that nebulous spectrum knows that there's something real there. And when we reflect on our own experiences within, we find traces of the same material. And yet, all of the conventional ways of talking about these things, the pharmacology, the psychiatric categories, all of these become a little bit unclear, or perhaps very unclear, and so we're left in some ways in a very familiar muddle around the issue of craziness. A friend of mine, I've known and in a way been blessed to know a number of people who have had very interesting kinds of mental disorders throughout their lives, because it's given me a more personal view of individuals, some of whom have been on this show, who have spent some time in the far ends of things, and in the way that I can understand very clearly that something very profound and very real and very troubling and traumatic is happening, not just to the way they behave in the world, but just in their own experiences. And yet at the same time, it's also allowed me to see, frankly, the lack of success after going through extraordinary regimens, different modalities, new age, psychiatric, pharmacological, social, et cetera, and really coming to the place of knowing people who really just live with their disorders in various kinds of ways. So it remains an extremely murky place, but I think a very important one to pay attention to, the issues of mental illness, because one, we're getting more and more of it. If you haven't heard, there's definitely a mental health crisis on board across at least the developed world, perhaps everywhere. Of course, it's partly related to the social stresses of our turbulent world. And so it's important to tune into them. But it's also important because I think that understanding the history of madness or insanity or mental illness, the fact that there are different words for this is already indicating part of the issue, which is that it's an extremely volatile zone where our ideas about what's going on help shape the reality of what people experience. And so there's a very profound feedback loop between our ideas and the experiences and states that people find themselves in, which means, at least in my book, that the best way to approach this is historically, that you really need to understand, if we're going to wrestle with what it means to be mentally ill or to be thinking about different possible solutions, what do we do with these situations individually, collectively, socially, you really have to understand it historically, because it gives you a sense of the complexity of the issue and also how much our own ideas and institutions and industries, including the pharmaceutical industry, play in constructing what it is this thing is, even as it continues to be clearly a real phenomenon and not just an invention of doctors and psychiatrists. So there's no better, there's no better source than I know at the moment than Mike Jay and his new book, This Way Madness Lies, The Asylum and Beyond. We've had Mike on the show before. He's, of course, has written a number of extraordinary books about the history of drugs and other books about mental illness, including the, you know, marvelous book, The Influencing Machine, which is published in the U.S. as A Visionary Madness, which is a completely wild ride into the origins of the notion of the influencing machine, that there are some kinds of, you know, some strange electromagnetic device that is beaming thoughts in my head and making me do things that I don't want to do, this very peculiar, very modern kind of form of paranoia or madness, you know, like everything has its own fascinating history. But his new book comes out of an exhibit that Mike curated at the Wellcome Collection in the UK called Bedlam, The Asylum and Beyond, which I believe is ending in about a week. So if you're, you know, if you're in London and you haven't gone, you should go. I wish I could go. I won't, I'll have to miss it. But luckily, the book, This Way Madness Lies, is full of wonderful photographs and objects and art pieces drawn from the exhibit. So it's a very rich read, and it's a really great one-stop shop for the history of madness in the modern world since the, you know, 17th and 18th centuries. So with no further ado, I'm happy to welcome Mike back on the show, man. Hey, thanks for joining
Eric,
us. Welcome on Expanding Mind.
Hey, very glad to be here.
So yeah, so tell me a little bit about the exhibit. How's it gone? I mean, that must have been quite a thrill to be able to bring your, you know, your historical obsessions and, you know, archive mania to bear on actually creating an exhibit rather than just than another bunch of words on a page. So yeah, tell me about the exhibit and how that's been.
Yeah, it's been a really interesting ride. It was very long gestating. I had a lot of time to think about it and did some traveling and looking at ideas of how we might present this story. Like you, I agree that you're absolutely right. I'm very drawn to historical approaches in general, but particularly with this subject, because I think they can tell us a lot about the landscape that we're in today and our ideas of mental health, and also about how, as you say, you know, this feedback loop operates. You know, this moving target that we're chasing. So it's a huge subject. It's structured as the book is around Bethlehem Hospital, which is sort of London's great first madhouse and then lunatic asylum and still now mental hospital. But it ranges much more widely. Trying to look at each of those worlds. So what was interesting for me was, if you approach this, you almost always kind of find your way down this track, which is a kind of history of psychiatry written by psychiatrists. So what was challenging and interesting to do in this exhibition was try and bring that perspective into dialogue with the patient's perspective, and also with the perspectives of reformers and kind of cultural perspectives in general, to build up a sense of what all these different worlds were about and how they were experienced. So that was kind of challenging and interesting. It was very interesting to try and produce something that kind of worked for everybody, that worked for mental health service users or patients or people with mental health issues or their families, as well as being, you know, honest and true to, you know, the perspective of doctors and psychiatrists, you know, and architects and mental health nurses and everybody who's involved. So trying to create worlds that people, you know, from all these perspectives and disciplines could walk through and recognize. And that was really interesting to do. And I guess, you know, it's in some sense, it doesn't dismiss the medical foundations of the subject, but it tries to look beyond them and particularly to look from the patient's perspective. And that's what's been very interesting about having the exhibition running for a period of time in London with a big events program around it, which has very much been led by mental health activists and artists, and has tried to approach this subject in a way that's inclusive, and I think that kind of feels new. That's been going on for a while, but it's been very, very interesting to give that a big stage in the middle of a big city and see how it unfolds.
Yeah, I mean, I want to, you know, I'd like to talk more about that. And, you know, in a way, I can tell that my temptation will be just to talk about contemporary situations, because there's so much going on. There's a mental health crisis around the world. There's all of these issues around drugs, and there's so much stuff that's going on. What I wanted to say was, again, why I think history is so important to study. And not just as a way to understand as a knowledge base, but as a way to think, because in the desire to represent all of these different views, if you kind of just take a slice of now, it's really complicated, because like, well, why am I going to take this guy's view versus that guy's view? We're all aware of the multi-perspectival nature of reality and how do we narrate it. But if you go through the way that you have done, and that kind of multiplicity is very much in the book too, where you just acknowledge that at every step of the way, even as there's medical advances and they're making these claims, and at the same time there's artifacts that show a different story, there are personal accounts that tell a different story, there are, you know, critics from the outside, and they're all part of the story. And so by weaving together these multiple strands, I mean, in a way you make things more complicated, because, oh my God, you know, which one is, how do we think about all these different approaches? But at the same time, there's a gesture towards opening a space, which sounds like the exhibit and the events around it have also done, where you open up a space where there's something that these different perspectives can feed into, because there is a general sense that we need to think about this again, constantly. We've always had to think about it anew. It's like your story is one of constant change.
Yes, and I think we're very... History gives us a lot of interesting ways into this, particularly it leads us out. I mean, just the, you know, the terms that we use that we struggle with, we kind of know that none of these terms really work, but kind of terms like mental illness immediately kind of presents what's going on as a medical problem and implies a medical solution. You know, that's a discourse that's very hard to escape. But, you know, as soon as you go back, you know, not very far into the past, you realize that it's always been the case, and it's always been recognized that mental health has many dimensions. It has a medical one, but it also has social and spiritual and environmental and psychological dimensions. So just the language of mental illness tends to collapse all these dimensions back into the medical and make it hard for us to think about them in any other way.
Yeah, I mean, I noticed that at the beginning, you know, I don't really script my intros, and I was just, oh God, what word am I going to use? I mean, that was one of the questions I wanted to ask you, is like, to say madness or crazy, is there's still a sense that that's besmirching the people who are suffering these things, or it's an archaic term that reflects a kind of lack of sophistication. And yet at the same time, mental illness, like you say, brings along this whole baggage, which isn't just, you know, the medicalized model, but of course also the pharmaceutical industry, because those two things have been intimately, you know, bound together for, you know, 100 years or so. And so if we talk about the mental health crisis or mental illness, in a way, you're already like supporting this paradigm that is problematic, and it's part of, you know, it's in the picture. It's very powerful, but it's also like, in a way, unconsciously supporting one of the models. But the word I want to know more about is lunatic. Where does lunatic start? I know that's part of your story.
Yes, I think, you know, just to respond to that, ultimately, I don't think there is a good collective term for what we're talking about, because what we're really talking about is just millions of different experiences, conditions, ways of being in the world. And all they really have in common is that they fall outside the boundaries of what we might call normal. But then what we call normal is a moving target. It keeps on shifting. So I think madness is an interesting term to return to. It's because, precisely because, unlike mental illness, it takes in, you know, it's got a big metaphorical and a big literary reach. You know, it speaks well beyond the medical. But it was like lunacy and insanity. You know, it was a term that kind of was overthrown about 100 years ago with the, you know, when you can go back to this moment, the sort of development of it in the early 20th century of the mental hospital, and you can catch the point where the idea of mental illness was very progressive, that this was saying, unlike, you know, the people who were locked up for life in 19th century asylums because they were lunatics or because they were mad, this framing of mental illness is, you know, it suggests an analogy with physical illness. This is something that anybody can suffer from and that anyone can get better from. It's not a destiny, you know, it's something that can be contained and dealt with. So you can catch that moment where the idea of mental illness was progressive, but at the same time, I think 100 years later, you can understand why so many people prefer to self-describe as mad rather than mentally ill, because, you know, it's much more open. There's many different ways of interpreting it. Lunacy is an interesting one, and that was the sort of statutory term through the 19th century, and it goes way back further. And, you know, as you imagine, it suggests a connection with the moon. In that sense, it's interesting because it implies a kind of periodicity. If you're a lunatic, then you're not, you know, sometimes, you know, you're in the grip of this thing and sometimes you're not. You might recover from it. It might be cyclical. So in a way that I think was lost through history, it also puts the condition, you know, it allows the individual, the person, to breathe within the condition and suggests that lunacy is something that periodically grips them but doesn't define them.
Yeah, that's a really wonderful point, and I'm still thinking about the comment you just made that's related to that, about how people choose to use words like mad to describe their condition rather than mentally ill because it's more open. And what I flashed on was something that I think certainly happens a lot in San Francisco, where not only do we have a very large homeless population, but the homeless population has a lot of mad people in it, to use that term for now. More so, I remember when I moved here from New York City, when I moved in the mid-90s, there were still a lot of homeless people in Manhattan. And I don't know where they chased them to, but there were still a lot of folks. But they were, you know, mentally ill, sure. But coming out to San Francisco was a whole other ball game. Like, you know, it's part of the fabric of the place. And I was thinking about it when you see people on the street and they're visibly behaving non-normally, that to think of them as mentally ill, while it kind of has a nice sort of politically correct blandness to it, it also creates more distance. Whereas there's a kind of weird relationship that you can have with people. And I know I experience this a lot because they can tell that I'm interested, you know, so they tune in that, like, here's someone they can talk to. So I often have these conversations with people that are sometimes a little scary, but I always do it. I always talk with them. And I realize if I'm going to talk to them, thinking about them as mentally ill doesn't really – it just puts me in a weird place. Like, I'm some kind of doctor, like I know something about them. I don't. But if I go mad, they're mad. There's something open, and amazing conversations can happen, or they're crazy, or they're loony, or whatever, some kind of more nebulous word. And yet that's not the way science works. That's not the way that's not how you get people into asylums. It's not the way the law works. So there's this tension between the open-ended aspect of it and the way in which it has to be kind of constructed as a specific thing in society.
I think that's right. And I think the other thing that happens with the term mental illness is it presents itself as a kind of neutral voice of the clinic, as a diagnosis. But a diagnosis of mental illness is, you know, is many things. You know, not all of them are very clearly advertised. Usually it's instrumental. It either gives you something or it compels you to do something. You know, it can, you know, hospitalize you against your will, or it can, you know, give you medical insurance, or it can win you rights to this kind of treatment. It's a ticket to something one way or another. And that's another way, thing that we're discouraged from thinking about by using this medical language. And I think that gets us back to the beginning of, you know, the idea of madness has always been, you know, who's mad and who isn't. Well, it's kind of instrumental who kind of copes in society and who doesn't, who has somehow fallen through, you know, this social net that the rest of us kind of sit, you know, however comfortably within. So you have, yeah, the people you can talk to. I mean, one thinks of, I don't know, maybe think of somebody like Sun Ra. He's from Saturn, right? You know, but you don't have the conversation with or about Sun Ra in kind of terms of mental illness, because there's no need to. Here's somebody who is taking a large jazz orchestra around, you know, around the country, you know, who's sort of, you know, extraordinarily competently managing his affairs. So in a way, you know, it's, I think it's we can kind of seek definitions and distinctions of what's going on within the mind, but I think they've actually evolved historically through, you know, much more instrumental considerations of daily life and who needs help and who needs support and who can cope and who can't.
Yeah, and of course, those that means that the story of madness is also a story of the changes in modernity, the way that our lives have changed so drastically in the wake of industrialism and the wake of science and the wake of, you know, changes in how we organize society. And so it feels like we should maybe like talk a little bit about the beginnings of the book, where we first see the sort of move towards the madhouse as mm-hmm. the problem of the mad becomes more visible inside, you know, increasing urban areas. There's more density. There's some breakdown in the traditional family, because, of course, initially, you know, in the old days, you know, mad people were part of the community, or if they weren't part of the community, maybe they'd make their way to a church, or they would wander the roads. There wasn't this sort of sense of gathering them together. So what was going on in society that led to this idea of like, hey, let's build a big building and keep them all there?
Yeah, it kind of emerges in the, I guess, the 17th century, sort of first in the Netherlands, and then, you know, the first sort of modern incarnation of Bethlehem, which up until that point had just been kind of a cloister, a priory, a monastery building, which took in the needy. You know, you start to get these madhouses being built in cities which are reinventing themselves, managing their own affairs, becoming more proud of the way in which they manage their affairs. And it's always accompanied by, you know, a great sense of civic pride and, you know, compassion and humanity. You know, it's not these people's fault that they're mad. They shouldn't be whipped from pillar to post. They shouldn't be locked up in dungeons. They shouldn't have to live out in the streets. They should, you know, have a roof over their heads and food to eat. But this is always shadowed, I think, and this is still, you know, true today, I think, by a kind of idea of social cleansing, that in our new kind of modern sort of clean sort of self-managed cities, we don't want to see homeless mad people around all the time. We kind of want to put them somewhere. So it's an odd mixture of, on the one hand, I think, you know, a genuine popular sentiment of wishing the best for mad people, but also kind of not wanting to have them in your face every day.
Yeah, it's so interesting is that raises this issue of architecture. I mean, the cover of the book is this beautiful fantasized blueprint of an institution by one of its patients. And a lot of the story is told through architecture, which is, for me, is a great way, again, of approaching history, because somehow architecture embodies both very intimate and very human scale of the kind of theater of our lives. And at the same time, you can see literally in the structure of the buildings, how they're laid out, how what the artistic elements are, what the structure what the various structures are. You can see the kind of abstract concept of what's happening change over time, and it seems like there's something particularly pertinent about architecture, weirdly, with the issues of madness and where people live and how we encounter it.
Yeah, and the sort of the first modern incarnation of Bethlehem is extraordinarily eloquent on that level, because it's modeled after a sort of French royal palace. It's absolutely palatial, sort of beautiful, very, very ornamental, with kind of sort of swags and stone decorations, these incredibly striking sculptures of melancholy and raving madness, these two figures over the gates. And everyone talks about it at the time as a palace for lunatics. And, this is kind of, it's one of the most talked about, in the London of Christopher Wren, a city that's trying to sort of raise itself up to, international kind of world status. It's one of the most talked about buildings. And yet behind this facade, the two actual galleries for male and female patients are incredibly basic. And also the weight of the facade is such that almost immediately, it's designed by Robert Hooke, the kind of great Enlightenment sort of figure of the sort of the Secretary of the Royal Society. But nevertheless, almost immediately, the weight of the facade starts opening up huge cracks. There are no kind of ties between the different parts of the building. There's no real foundation for it. It's kind of built on sort of rubble of the old London walls. So you have, and everybody picked it up at the moment, immediately at the time, this incredible metaphor in stone that it's this facade of kind of wonderful care and then this kind of abyss of neglect behind it.
It's extraordinary. And then another interesting thing you talk about is how it was a source of popular entertainment. I mean, it's one of the things about, not that long ago, just a few hundred years ago, that there were forms of popular entertainment that would disgust most of us today, like public hangings, like let's go see the hanging. And along with that cheery experience, you could go to the go to Bethlehem and check out the Mad. So how did that work? Like how did it become kind of a source of entertainment, and what was going on with that?
Well, that's the one thing that it's remembered for, that kind of, my God, they used to let people in for public entertainment. And I think we, that seems very alien to us. There may be things in our culture that are perhaps more analogous to it than we like to think. It really started because, then as now, as ever, raising charitable funds for mental health care is a tough business. Bethlehem was pretty cash strapped. And so the idea was that you'd open it up for visits and people would make donations. And it was kind of very high-minded in its intent. And lots of people, it's fascinating reading the records of people who went to visit Bethlehem, because it includes a lot of people for whom it was obviously a very moving experience, and a lot of people who feel motivated to give sort of charitable donations to support people who sort of thank God that they're more fortunate than these people in here. There's also a lot of people, obviously the families of the people there are going in and giving them food and stuff, and it's kind of Sundays and public holidays, it's big and it's crowded and people are selling alcohol outside, and you get these kind of crowds of kind of like, sort of daring young men kind of daring each other to taunt the patients, a lot of whom respond back again. And, it becomes this kind of strange world, a kind of space where somehow the normal kind of social rules are thrown out of the window, and it's this aspect of it that you get in the famous representations, like in Jonathan Swift in Tale of a Tub, or the most famous, William Hogarth in the sort of final painting of his Rake's Progress. His protagonist ends up in Bethlehem, kind of chained and raving on the floor, and you see these society women fluttering their fans and kind of just staring at them. What I included in the book and in the exhibition also is Hogarth was always very canny with keeping the copyright on his work. So, you know, after the after everyone had seen the painting, he'd turn out different riffs of it on engravings. And there's a later one where he kind of tips the wink to the audience, and he puts on the back wall, it's a big sort of coin of the realm with a sort of figure of Britannia, just to signal that this is kind of a looking glass, and this is Britain that we're looking at. This is, you know, and this idea that you get in the satires of the time that the world is a great bedlam, that somehow what's going on in here reflects the world outside. So a lot of the things I think that we see, the representations of visiting of bedlam, which look kind of nightmarish at first glance, are more satirical than we remember. What they're saying is, look at these people who come to visit the lunatics, and look at the lunatics that look from one to the other, and what actually is the difference, really?
Well, that's one of the great themes of your book, is how that in fact, you can almost see it through architecture, that architecture lets us pretend that there's another place over there where that other world goes. And yet, of course, there's always these interconnections. And in some sense, the story of psychiatry is a breakdown of that wall as people, there are new medicalized and socially progressive ways of trying to reintegrate mad people into society, but also at the same time recognizing that we all have a little bit of it in us. And in fact, you know, there's it's increasingly unclear where mental illness stops and, you know, so-called normal life begins. So that the very attempt to sort of create another world, or create a barrier or an institution for these people, almost like begs the question of, can we ever really think of ourselves as being outside of this particular problematic?
Yes, it's very interesting how medicine fits into that, because it's in the 19th century, the beginning of the, you know, the asylum becomes a real big part of the sort of social reform movement. So the same people who are sort of starting mutual societies and philanthropic endeavors, those are the people who are really pushing the idea of the asylum. And the idea of the asylum is that it's this kind of world outside the world, far from the madding crowd. It's this place where people who've become mentally disturbed or lost the ability to cope in the real world can experience a kind of ideal society. And these are often people who've, you know, have never, you know, have come from broken family backgrounds, have never really seen a sort of functional society. So there's this very utopian idea of the asylum, which is that this is the perfect utopian society. It's outside society with all the rough edges smoothed off, and that anybody who's kind of brought into it can find their way back and patch themselves back into society. This is kind of the that's the vision of it. And then kind of towards the end of the 19th century, when things start getting more medicalized, and it becomes very obvious that, you know, with the best will in the world, most people are not getting better. Most people are not coming out. More and more people are going in. As more and more people go in, care is getting more and more thinly stretched, and abuses and neglect are becoming more common. This is kind of a reproach to the first generation of psychiatrists, and they fall very much under the shadow of Darwin, and, you know, say this condition is hereditary, there's nothing can be done for it. So it's actually this, I think, you know, it's a fascinating psychodrama, in a sense, that when medicine emerges, it's confronted by its failure to do anything about these conditions, and it projects onto them this sense that these people are somehow not fully human, they're somehow not redeemable. So it's actually medicine that kind of builds that wall that you're talking about.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, just and then what happens with that medical impulse in the late 19th, early 20th century, where you start to get these sort of cures, because they discover that certain seemingly mental illnesses are actually the result of purely physical causes that can be treated and are treated in some set of circumstances. And then people go, all right, here we go. It's all physical. Let's medicalize it. Let's improve it. Here's the magic bullet. And we see the beginning of that whole magic bullet psychology, that, or whatever you want to call it, magic bullet narrative, mythology that goes along not just to, you know, contemporary psychiatric drugs, so a whole century of magic bullet drugs and practices like, you know, lobotomy and electroshock therapy, but also, frankly, technology, that it's the same kind of logic. There's these magic bullets. They give us a tremendous amount of power and improvement over some kind of confusion or nebulosity, but they have these hidden costs. Then we find that we get further and further into a cycle that we can't get out of anymore. I mean, it's really kind of it's not just about madness by the time you get to the 20th century. It's really about a whole way that modernity uses its powers, its technologies, its science in order to provide answers in these ways that are from a historical perspective, look like hype, they look like self-promotion, they look like mythology, even though they're also partly true, and it gets very complicated.
Yeah, and I think that's still the paradigm that we're in, you know, with this mental illness idea. It's very striking if you look back at the literature that accompanies the end of the mental hospitals in the 60s and 70s. You know, it's all doctors and psychiatrists giving opinions to politicians, which are all kind of along the lines of, well, of course, you know, by the time we get to the 21st century, there won't be any mental illness anymore. People will just, like, take a pill. You know, we don't need these hospitals anymore. You know, the state doesn't need to support this huge infrastructure of mental health care. It'll be like, something like diabetes or high blood pressure. You know, some people will just be kind of medicated for it, but it will become invisible. So that's really, you know, in a way, I think, you know, that's what sort of has been interesting with the exhibition as well, is to try and sort of energize a sense that that is still the paradigm. That was plan A for 50 years ago. You know, that was where we were supposed to be now. And we're not, you know, so we've got to reactivate some kind of idea about, medical treatment, psychiatric medication and so on. Great as far as it goes. May it go further, you know, may we, you know, we wish, you know, we wish it all the best, but we no longer hope that that is going to be the ultimate solution to this, you know, and there must be somewhere in the past kind of other approaches, which were discarded too soon and which actually are also part of the picture. Because if you go back 100 years, it's by no means obvious that this kind of biomedical paradigm is going to win out. You know, the people in the early days of electroshock and lobotomy, you know, they're radicals, you know. And they're less powerful institutionally than, for example, psychoanalysis, you know, or all kinds of sort of ideas of social psychology and care, you know. So it's extraordinary the way that this medical paradigm took hold and then still has us in its grip.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, do you see it now shifting? I started out at the top of the show talking about our kind of erosion of trust, something that, you know, on some level has been happening for a long time as people sort of begin to critique the foundations of modernity, whether it's reason or science or, you know, medical establishment, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, now we're at this kind of vertiginous point where there's so many competing accounts of, you know, health issues, mental health issues, et cetera, et cetera. What's happening with the medical model now? Are we still holding on to it because it's the only thing we can think of? Is it just part of a lot of different perspectives? Has it been that way for a while? Because pharmaceutical companies are so powerful and there's such this kind of imbrication of pharmaceuticals with medicine, it's this kind of massive block. And yet it also seems to be eroding in some ways if you look at practices of alternative healing and the ways in which institutions are drawing these things in. So what's happening with the medical model now in terms of mental illness?
I think a lot of, not everywhere, but I think that, you know, a lot of people within psychiatry are looking beyond it and trying to supplement it with ideas about kind of social engagement. I think one of the forces that does keeps it in place is not so much psychiatrists as patients, because, you know, the diagnosis of mental illness is an important thing to hang on to. For many people, it's, as I said earlier, it's a ticket to one thing or another. It's also a kind of, it defuses, you know, the personal nature of the condition. It's no longer a personal flaw, or as it might have been in the past, a sin. You know, it's something that no one can help. So a lot of psychiatrists report that, you know, that they often try and move their patients on to other models beyond the medical models, but it's the kind of resistance of the patients. And there's a strange kind of feedback loop that kind of through psychiatric medications and big pharma that kind of links this, because you'd think that I mean, when the first antidepressant was launched in the 50s, people, you know, the pharma would, you know, wasn't sure that this was a, you know, depression wasn't really a big deal at that point. And now, of course, depression is the condition of our age, but antidepressants are, you know, billion sellers. So it's this kind of odd, it's hard to construe the struggle between them, because both of them seem to be winning. You know, the more depression, the more antidepressants, and the more depression. And, you know, maybe the more that, you know, people's, you know, a kind of broader social distress from the sort of cultural factors that you mention, it kind of works for everybody to medicalize that and call it depression. It kind of works for doctors to diagnose it because there's a pill that they can give for it that might work. So it's this strange push me pull you in which everything has been kind of pulled into this clinical model. And it's and so I think it's kind of hard to shift from every direction, and it's very hard also to you know, because it's very hard to provide the stuff that really works. I mean, I think this is one of the themes that kind of emerges from following the history, is that you know, there have been lots of systems that worked in the past, you know, back in the, you know, the 19th century, the York Retreat and this Quaker model, you know, through to some, you know, amazing experimental therapeutic communities in the 60s and so on. But it's really about, you know, it takes a lot of time and a lot of hard work and a lot of compassion and a lot of resources to really look after people. So I think, you know, and if you try and do it without that, that's when you end up, you know, going back into the cycle of abuse and neglect. There's no real shortcut to that. But I think what we've had throughout the last century is really this idea of treatment being the sort of, you know, at the top of the hierarchy, treatment being something that's kind of biomedical and that's done, you know, by doctors and psychiatrists, you know, mostly by men, you know, and then kind of beneath treatment has been care or support, these ideas that these are kind of mopping up jobs that are done by, you know, nurses and mostly women and so on. I think what's becoming obvious to a lot of people is that treatment is great so far as it goes, but, you know, as you said at the top of the show, you know, these are conditions that people have to live with, and actually care and support is, you know, is what's more important. You know, if you can find a pill that works, that's great, but it's still, you know, what do you do the rest of the time? So I think there is a sense that people are starting to realize that there is a sort of more profound social dimension to this, that medication is never going to be the answer. It's not just a question of waiting for the next big pharma breakthrough or even for the next psychedelic. You know, there's always that in a way we've got to recover some of these other approaches that we've lost.
Yeah, I want to ask you about the psychedelics in a moment, because I know that you've written a great deal about them, and that plays an interesting role now in this discussion. But before that, I wanted to have you talk a little bit about, I might mispronounce the name of this town, Giel, in Belgium, which is a kind of a counter story throughout your narrative, this remarkable town where people have been living and interacting with mad people who were brought there in a kind of normalized way for centuries. And you visited the place. Now I know it's not quite what it used to be, but if you could just talk a little bit about this remarkable place and what it reminds us about the social dimension of treatment or care, in your terms.
No, absolutely. And it's been, let's call it Giel, so we don't have to tangle with the Flemish pronunciation. It's been one of the most remarkable parts of this project for me. It's been spending time there. It's a round about the same time that Bethlehem was originally founded as a kind of monastery or priory, in about the 13th century in the Middle Ages. There were various pilgrimage sites around Europe where you could take members of your family who were mentally disordered or distressed to try and heal them. And one of these was the shrine of St. Dimpna at Giel. And St. Dimpna was a saint with special powers of intercession for the mentally distracted. And people would take their family members there, and then you'd get there and you'd do the prayers and you'd walk around the shrine seven times and you'd sort of stay and you'd pray for 5 days. And, you know, after that, I guess some people were cured. A lot of other people weren't, and quite often their families would leave them there. And it was a farming community, so local families started taking these people in to work with them on their farms, giving them the bed and board and, fostering them effectively in exchange for, you know, an extra pair of hands. And this was a system that persisted. It was completely non-medical and still is, which is really interesting. They're known as boarders. They're not talked about in terms of their, diagnostic categories. Again, it's instrumental boarders. You know, they board with the family. That's what they do. That's how they're defined. In the mid-19th century, this became co-opted into the Belgian state healthcare system, and some very enlightened psychiatrists kind of kept it going pretty much as it was and interfered as little as possible. And this is, at its peak about 100 years ago, there were, 4,000 boarders in a town of 16,000 people. You know, it's kind of one in five, extraordinary numbers. It's not that anymore for various reasons, but it's still a town in which there are many hundreds of people who in other contexts would be diagnosed with severe learning difficulties or autism or severe mental health issues like, psychoses, who live kind of in the town, who have families who look after them. And, you know, it's kind of it's fascinating just to be there, because you can see very clearly how what we call mental illness has two kind of separate components. I mean, one is whatever's going on in your head, which is distressing and painful and hard to deal with. But then the second component is having to deal with a world full of normal people who don't get this. And that's, you know, often the more distressing part. And it's very interesting to see in a town like Giel, when that is removed and you know that you're in a community who are used to this, where everybody has grown up in this context. And it just feels remarkably normal and easy to have a society which is more mentally different than you'd normally expect. It's well controlled, so not, people are, people are vetted initially to make sure that this is going to work for them. You really don't, it's very calm. It's a very calm, sort of stolid, sort of rural town. They have, they have very little problem with kind of, violent outbursts or kind of difficult behavior, all the things that people fear. Just don't really, in fact, they have kind of the opposite problem. A lot of people who feel that, who become very withdrawn in public because they're scared of doing something out of turn or kind of, acting in a way that's going to make them be sent back to a hospital. So that, in fact, people spend a lot more time saying, no, it's fine. You can do what you want. You can stand on a chair if you want, you can walk. So, it's been very interesting to it is a very interesting demonstration of how big the social component of this condition is, and how if you have a community that's really prepared to tolerate this and to kind of accept it as part of life, a lot of the sort of medical dimension kind of melts away. And so I think this is another component of our idea that, you know, everything is too medicalized, and you know, we kind of end up, we put a lot of this on psychiatry because we, you know, as communities, don't really, you know, I mean, psychiatry kind of, you know, in Gill as elsewhere, needs to be there as a kind of backstop when things get out of control. But in fact, it's needed much, much less than you'd think. So I think what's interesting about Gill is it's fascinating to witness, but it also makes us realize how kind of this is a social problem for everybody concerned. And social solutions are available, but they require a kind of community cohesion that we're is lacking in the modern age.
Yeah, very much. You know what it makes me think of? I suspect someone studying this is that, you know, at least in, you know, in the West Coast, both in Los Angeles and increasingly in San Francisco, we see these very large, you know, tent communities. So you have homeless people. And some of them are quite complex. They have their own, you know, they, like any sort of shanty town, they start to develop their own ways of dealing with food and waste. And, you know, they develop their own kind of ways of little, their little societies. Mm-hmm. And it would be fascinating to find out how the people who are not mad, who are living in those situations, what the culture is like of the relations between people who are also, who are mentally ill. And sometimes they go off the rails, and some, and sometimes they're not. And there must be very rich, you know, obviously highly stressed and far from ideal situations, but that there must be interesting ways in which homeless populations learn to engage and deal with mental illness in a different way than the rest of us, because they have to kind of cooperate with it, or it's in their face in a direct way. And I'm sure sometimes it's very unpleasant, but I suspect that there must be some interesting and you know, social responses to this that would be positive.
I'm sure that's right. It would be very interesting, and it would also, I'm sure, have very interesting resonances with periods in the past where this was the normal condition of life for the majority of people.
Well, that's an interesting thing about periods of the past. One of my favorite things about your conclusion is you're talking about depression, which you mentioned before, as being kind of the disorder of our age. You start talking about all the different kinds of solutions people have, and all the, if you look at like all the different ways that people treat that and other mental disorders now, from drugs to spiritual regimens to exercise to different forms of social therapy to different forms of psychiatry. I mean, it's just like this whole mess, and it looks like, oh, this is what postmodernity is. This is what it means to be in a modern world after the reign of science. And then you go, yeah, but actually, it's not that different than the anatomy of melancholy. You go back to the 17th century, and you get a very clear description of the same kind of disorder, and you also have a panoply of approaches. You know, it's like, in a way, you know, our while we can really talk about these things in terms of our contemporary moment, it also seems that there's something perennial about both these conditions and the kind of complex meshwork of responses that we have to them.
Yes, and I think, you know, as well as historical, it's also cross-cultural, you know, that pretty much every culture around the world has a mixture of medical and non-medical approaches for these kind of conditions, and different ways of looking at them in different contexts. They're kind of defined more or less medically. One of the things we've managed to get in the exhibition, which is fantastic, kind of sitting there in this kind of collection of materials about, you know, the modern sort of, you know, market for different therapies, you know, and ranges of different approaches, is the case books of Richard Napier, who was a contemporary of Robert Burton's, sort of 17th century, and his casebooks have survived in the Bodley, and they're about the only sort of medical casebooks of that period, and they're fascinating because he was a doctor, but he worked together with Simon Forman, the alchemist. So you have these case books in which often the first thing that Napier does is to cast a horoscope. So you have these wonderful sigils on the page with kind of thin scribbles all around them. And what might come out of this horoscope might be some kind of herbal remedy. It might be some fierce mercury purge, or it might be cranial surgery. You know, it kind of could be anything. So it's wonderful to sit that in a contemporary context and let them inform each other.
That, and it, and I think that's also partly what's helpful with histories like yours, which really show the kind of anthropological dimension of science and medicine. You know, we think of these things as being sort of pure and based on peer review, and it's something we can really rely on. But of course, the closer you look at it, the fuzzier things get. And your book, your whole approach, really it helps in, you know, the reader. It helped me kind of open up to the multiplicity of these different therapies, medical and non-medical, and seeing that they're all kind of mixtures of you know,